Welcome to the Boost VC podcast. At Boost VC, we are the accelerator that invests the first $500,000 into sci-fi tech startups. And this show is all about talking to investors and founders to dig into the latest topics around sci-fi tech and building great companies. I'm your host, Adam Draper, founder and managing director of Boost VC. Are you ready to rock? Today, I got to interview Aleem Mawani. He is the CEO and founder of Streak CRM, which is a customer relationship management tool. I'm sure many of you use it out there for your fundraises. It is the best for it being integrated into Gmail. Now, what we did talk about was mostly around product. However, I think one of the biggest elements of this conversation focused around what we called working horses, which there are unicorns, but what happens if you just build a good business that happens to be a tech business and it's not Google, but it's great and it grows steadily year over year. It's profitable. It just churns out cash. And this concept that we discussed is an important concept for entrepreneurs to really understand, is that there are many ways to build a successful career and a successful business. I always love hearing Aleem's thoughts on the world and how sort of his product mind just builds out this incredible. He really is customer centric. He talks to his customer all the time. That's the thing that he focuses on when it has to do with what new features to build. And I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Welcome to the Boost VC podcast. Today, we are blessed with Aleem Mawani of Streak CRM, who I think it was like 5 years ago, we had Aleem speak during the Boost VC program. And he was one of my favorite speakers because he had this concept of how to talk to your customers, which just sort of like broke down, in my opinion. A lot of founders think if you build it, they will come. Like that was I always run into this. And it was just a good way to have any developer, any founder, like think through. I think what you called it was ask why five times. That was the thing.
Right.
But and we'll get into that. So welcome, Aleem.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Yeah. No. I'm amped. I feel like we're reconnecting too. So this is always nice. So okay. First, can you give us I've been using Streak CRM for probably 5 years now, probably basically since you spoke. It was a perfect timing for us where we needed a CRM solution. By the way, Streak CRM is the CRM that is integrated straight into Gmail, targeting small, medium businesses, great for founders. And for fundraising, you have templates and it's amazing. I've had to fundraise a bunch and it worked. What led you originally to get into sort of building out CRM for Gmail specifically?
Right. Yeah, then this will kind of touch in on some of the product stuff we talked about, but we didn't really come up with the idea out of thin air. We were actually working on a different company prior to Streak, and that company required us to do sales, like most companies, but we were doing basically door-to-door sales for our previous company, and we basically knew nothing. We knew nothing about sales. We knew it was our first company. So we were just like literally walking down, you know, Folsom Street in San Francisco, like knocking on doors and like trying to sign up these local businesses. And then we come back home at the end of the day, back to the office, and we'd be like, okay, like tell us about the deals you closed. Tell us about, you know, the other deals. And we'd be trading these notes and we'd be like, oh, I think this is what a CRM is for. I think we need a CRM. And so we did kind of what most people did, you know, get Salesforce. And, you know, Salesforce is a great product for Fortune 500 companies, but if you've ever used it, you know that like for a small team, especially two people, it's like way overkill. It makes no sense.
It is overkill. We did try to institute it in our 5-person team at one point, and we were just right. Like, no, this is not for us.
Yeah, I mean, the training cycle, the consulting cycle, that whole thing, you know, it takes you 6 months to just get onboarded to the product. So we realized we needed something, and we were shocked at like how few solutions there were that were good. And so we did what most people do, is you go to like a Google spreadsheet, right? And you just share the spreadsheet with your team. And it's great because you get to define the rows and you get to define the columns, like it's whatever schema you want, which is great. Problem is, you're doing all your sales over email. And so you're getting all these emails back and forth, and then your CRM's in your spreadsheet. And so you're like copying data back and forth. And that just kills people, because all of a sudden, as soon as you start forgetting, it becomes out of sync. As soon as you don't trust it, you stop using it, it becomes more out of sync. So it gets really painful really quickly.
So you were sort of listening to your own pain point while you built this other company.
Yeah. And when that other company didn't survive, basically, we realized like, hey, we should build something that we know that like at least one person in this world needs. And that one person is us, you know, like, you know, the previous company failed for this exact reason, right? Like we built something that was like an idea, right? Not a customer being like, I have this problem, or not us being, I have this problem, but it was more like, huh, wouldn't it be cool if this existed in the world? And like, wouldn't it be cool is like famous last words.
Actually, that'd be a great, if you want to write a blog post, I would love to read that blog post, because wouldn't it be cool is cool, right?
Right. It'd be cool, but it wouldn't be successful.
But like, it's not filling a real, it is the if you build it, they will come scenario, where it's like, it's cool enough, you know?
Right.
Although maybe games is this place where that's not right. I don't know.
I think games is, it's also true for games that you need a customer, but in this case, the customer is yourself, because you're building things like fashion and games and a lot more of the creative arts are like, you know, it's all about taste. And ideally, the person that's building it has good taste, and they assume that if they have good taste, other people that also have good taste will want that as well. But you are building for your own taste as well in that case. So yeah, I think it's kind of similar.
So on that this sort of vein in products in general, not only games, and also, I mean, in a lot of ways, you build Streak out for your own taste, right? Like you have your own concepts. In that world, you've made a bunch of iterations of the product. It's been, how long have you been live for?
8 years.
8 years. And we're on like big update just happened for V3, right? Like,
right.
There are a lot of iterations, but like big update where it's like huge change. What is your sort of like engine process for figuring out what you should add and shouldn't add to your product?
Right. You know, I used to think like, oh, there's like one product management technique that you should use and like stick with that. But as sort of time has gone on, I kind of feel like there's a different, you should use different techniques in different situations. And so the technique that we use, you know, so many years in with an existing user base is going to be much different than the technique you might use with a brand new product that has zero users. Now, that being said, it's also not the case that your product is only in one of these types of development modes.
You guys have been live for 8 years?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. So the first version.
Sorry, it's just making me feel old. I feel like the last 8 years went. By the way, I have a great pink pen. It's my 6-year-old daughter's. I just held it up. I was like, I need to explain this pink pen. But like, it's making me. I've started to feel like there's this new wave generation of founders that's coming. Where I I don't know. It's weird. I have a weird like I'm older now thing that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's what people don't realize. It takes a long time to build these businesses, right? And like the first, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, like you would have looked at the product and been like, this is a toy, this is nothing, you know, like I didn't even know this existed. And most people didn't know it existed. But those early gains sort of compound, and like, you know, in the later years, that's when things become really, really big and successful. But yeah, so there are elements of the product development process that we use as if we were a brand new company. And so like, for example, we're looking at other product areas that Streak could expand into. And so for that, it's as if we're building a new product, and the product management technique that we're using there is, you know, embed ourselves with customers, just listen to as many of their stories as we can, their problems.
Is it things that you can sort of like upsell on that you're like browsing, or is it like a,
if you think about a sales process, there's like, it goes all the way from like, I don't know what I'm selling to like, I know what I'm selling. Now I got to find out who I'm selling to. Now I got to reach out to them. Now I got to like do the negotiation and do the deal. Now I got to maintain that account. It's like this long, long funnel. And right now Streak is only in one part of that funnel where you engage with the customer. And so we want to go on both sides of that, which is, and so probably the next area is like, hey, how do you reach out to these customers at scale or leads at scale before they're customers? And so, yeah, so for our existing users, this will be, you know, something that we give them for free. And the reason that we don't want to upsell them is because Streak already has a pretty premium price point. And so for us, it's more important, instead of upselling them, it's more important for us to retain them. Bundling other products with our existing product, we hope.
By the way, what I've learned about CRMs is they're very sticky. It's basically like once you're on one, you you've sort of committed for a couple of years, like, or
yeah,
at least,
yeah.
Well, if you have gotten your team committed to it, that takes a while to like actually believe in it, but then it's there. Like, I'm not, yeah, we can't switch off streak. Like, it would be impossible, right, for us basically.
Right.
So like, we're right, just, you started charging us more at one point and we were like, okay. It was like, you, I guess, have all of our data, please. Right. Like, what, right, like, we'll keep that safe. I don't want it going away.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's a great benefit. And up until the point where it completely breaks your process, right? Like, if it breaks you, you're gonna do the work to move on to something else. And that's the part that we want to prevent.
You don't want to ruin the trust of the customer, but it's a high cost for the customer also to change.
Right.
And for it's very interesting. You're the rails of the customers. Like, you're the rails.
Right.
So on that note, charging more, how do you make that decision?
I mean, it's so hard. Yeah, definitely true. The common wisdom is that like pricing is an art, not a science. And I wholly buy into that. The way we priced our product initially was to basically say we were a free product for a long time. And we basically went to some of our customers that were using us heavily and basically said, hey, we got to charge for this product. We're starting to charge for it. The price is $10 a user a month. And the first customer was like, okay, cool. End of conversation. So the next customer I talked to, I said, the price is $20 a user a month. And customer's like, okay, cool. And I basically just kept increasing it by 10 bucks every customer I talked to until somebody said, oh, that seems a little pricey. You might have to consider something. And at first we wanted the price to just be the no-brainer price. What's the price where, like, you know, you're not even gonna care about it. You're just gonna pull the trigger on it, right? The difference between, for our use case, for our customers, the difference between 10 bucks and 15 bucks and 20 bucks is like not important to them. They don't really care either way. So you might as well charge 20 because it doubles your revenue. But there is a point at which they start caring, and we wanted to find that point. So that's how we got to our first price, which was like 40 bucks or something. And then we've raised the prices twice since then. We've gone to 50 and now 60. And that's mostly because, A, when we did it, we didn't see that much difference in conversion rates. There was a little bit of difference, but not that much. But the other thing is that it helps with our product. Once you start getting into these prices and you start having 10 user deals, 20 user deals, customers want to negotiate. They want to negotiate because they feel like they got a good deal. And so there's sort of two ways to handle that. One is you say, hey, there's like, we don't do any negotiation whatsoever. You make that public, but people will still want to negotiate and you're going to lose deals if you don't. And so we basically price it at 60 bucks now, expecting that some set of those users are going to want to negotiate. And then that gets us back to our normal price.
Okay. So if you were talking to like, I don't know how often you sort of coach other startups or have friends who are building companies, but if you were to like on the pricing thing, not in actually just charging thing, like right, just charging for your product, like at what point do you start to have that conversation? Because I bet there was not a fear, but sort of a, it's free right now.
Right.
Moving to paid. Was there a fear you were going to lose everyone?
Well, I think it depends on who your customer is, right? Like if your product is for like enterprise customers, you start charging from day one because you want to know whether this thing, you could sell this thing. And at first that wasn't us. You know, at first we were almost a consumer play. Like we were almost like single two user deals, in which case it's more about like, can you reach enough people? And then charging is sort of secondary. And for us, because we were building a CRM, we were basically saying like, hey, what's the risk that we won't be able to charge them later? And we were basically like, there's not a lot of risk there at all. Salesforce charges people 120 bucks a month. I'm sure we can charge half that. You know, I'm sure we can charge a third of that. Like, I'm not worried about people not paying. People are used to paying for CRMs. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about, can we build a good product? Can we get it into the hands of customers? So for us, it made sense to go be free for a while and then charge. Now, in retrospect, I think we were free for a little bit too long. But I think the general advice is just think about like the risk that you won't be like, is it a risk to your business that maybe you won't be able to charge people money?
I was like, wait a second, I can change this background. So on the topic of charging, do you talk to other founders and stuff? Like, do they approach you?
Oh, yeah, saying, totally.
Like, hey, I'm in this situation. So it does totally depend. So I would say enterprise, you're a small, medium business. You're selling to small, medium businesses. Right. You own this sort of small, medium business CRM market.
Right.
But do you run into a lot of founders? I just run into all these founders who don't want to charge for the product because they think no one's going to use it. But then there's this big fear that like, but then they don't think about sustainability of their business. So one of the things, right, I always try to drive into their heads is just like, money is good. Make money.
Right.
Make money.
Right. Yeah, it's fuel. It's totally fuel. And so, you know, we were fortunate enough to raise a little bit of money at the beginning. And so we didn't have that pressure of like money. And I almost wish we did a little bit because it would have forced us to charge a little sooner. But once we felt that pressure, we started charging. And
that's an interesting downside of fundraising. Where you had zero, now you have money, you can wait 2 years or whatever, and you can sort of like over-optimize.
Imagine you're one of these like super hot companies and you raise like $20 million or something like that, right? And like your revenue, if you started charging, would be like $1 million, $500,000 or something like that. You're looking at that and you look at that delta and you're just like, this is not interesting. Like, it's not interesting to have an extra $500,000.
And how does that look to the next round or whatever? Like, exactly. There's a little bit of a fear of that thing.
Yeah, if I start making money, then now somebody has a way to value me, and it's not what I want it to be.
Yeah, I know. It's venture is going through a really interesting time. I mean, the pandemic is just interesting for everyone, but we're going through a really interesting time where we do, you know, it is asymmetric returns, and people are willing to sort of bet $20 million. To see, and it needs to be the right team, and like, you know, people think it's silly, but most of the time it works. It's like not most of the time, 10% of the time. You know, there are a lot of startups. You're a profitable startup, so like you're a little bit of an anomaly in venture capital. Not you shouldn't be, but you are an anomaly. What's that like?
Yeah, it's different. Like, we hit profitability basically as soon as we started charging for our product. And it's because we were free for so long and we built this user base. Product was good and people wanted to pay for it.
And what was your background before this? You worked at Google, right?
Yeah, I was at Google. And so, you know, a little bit of background in free products. And it was all about scale and like, oh, get all the users first and then figure out, you know, stuff later. You know, that works great for Google, but maybe not so much for startups. So yeah, I was at Google before. And very different product development process, very different strategic process, obviously, for a large company than a smaller
one. And you actually ended up choosing to build CRM for Gmail.
Yeah, I mean, I was just so familiar with the product and so familiar with the team there. And I worked on a few projects on Gmail. And so it was just very natural.
Has that been helpful? Like, did you need the relationship with Google in order to be successful in building sort of like a very integrated system?
I don't think it was not needed to have that relationship to build the product that we built, but it was reassuring because we kind of understood their long-term vision, their strategy, and how that team operated. And we knew that like this product could be successful. And so it felt less risky for us than it might from the outside.
Oh, so it mitigated some risk just to know them. What are sort of the issues with building on a truly centralized, like you made the choice. You know, like Zynga built on Facebook and it sort of ended up being a tough thing, but only after they scaled a lot. Like, what have been the tough things about building on a centralized service?
The big risk and the thing that everyone's worried about, the question that we got asked all the time was like, oh, but what if Gmail just built this? And it's like, okay, that's platform risk.
Problems if Gmail closes. Like,
sorry, not even closes, but if they build what you're building. Like, and so we got that question a lot. And this is the area I think it was helpful to know the team and the strategy at Google, which is basically they're not interested in vertical solutions, right? They're interested in like, how do I get the next billion users? And they don't get the next billion users by having these specialized vertical use cases. And so we knew it wasn't really a platform risk for us. Now, from the outside, people thought it was a platform risk. So that, you know, that's one area that does get risky.
That's such a good answer too. The CEO of DocSend, when he spoke at Boost, he said he kept having the same question: would Box basically, what if Box just builds this? He said, so we went to Box and we went to talk to them about like if they were going to build this, and and it's like unlocking that ability just to be able to say like, there's no way that this is a priority for them.
Right. I mean, you should definitely know the people on the platform team, because like I think people don't realize like it's really easy to talk, like especially first-time founders, they might think like, oh, like how do I know what Google's thinking? Oh, just go talk to them. They're just people, just like anybody else. Just go
reach out. You know what I love about every answer that you've been giving me is it's the do the thing that doesn't scale. Basically, like every single step along the way, it's so when we talk to people in person, we were battling one-on-one, like we were, but you were talking to them, right? Like, and then that's like integrated into your DNA at this point. You just go you're like, with the platform team, we reached out to the platform team. Like we're just, you know, friends.
I mean, everything at the beginning is like that. And then because every new project at Streak is like the beginning, you're just kind of always doing that, right? You're always doing the thing that like you didn't think. Like from the outside, people are like, oh, I can't believe you have this partnership with Google. It's like, not really. We just like talk to them. Yeah. Like, it's really easy.
And we'll call it a partnership.
Yeah. I mean, now we have more official partnership and stuff like that. But like at the beginning, yeah, it was just like, yeah, we just talked to them. But yeah, the other risk that you face with these platforms is like, what if they change their product in a way that's not aligned with your product? And so one worry about Gmail is like, oh, what if they change it so that there's no threading or there's no conversations and whatever, and you've built your product with that mindset. And I think the other thing that de-risked it for us is just like, we know email's been around for 30 years. It's kind of hard to like really innovate on the model. There's a bunch of people trying, but like, it's pretty clear that like lists of conversations and conversations is kind of the model.
Well, they're innovating on right now building distribution on interfaces, right? Like, yeah, I like this trend of luxury digital brands, and it's almost personality type software. So like, this is a longer conversation probably, but like, I use Tempo. I don't know if you've heard of Tempo. Mm-hmm. It is perfect for me who like looks at all of the windows at the same time and it just focuses me. That's been really great. I feel like the innovations are user interface driven as of now, right? To me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably fair.
You built an email thing at one, but like your app basically is email, right?
Yeah. We have an email client on our iOS app, and people should definitely not underestimate the amount of work it is to build an email client. There is a crazy amount of work and education,
right?
and a super long feature list. And which is why like you have all these companies that are trying to innovate on the user interface side of email. But the problem is they get their wheels stuck in just getting the bare basics done, right? Before you can do your one cool innovation on top of email, you got to build an email client that's fully functional. Otherwise, people can't use it, right? Like everybody has their pet feature. I need signatures. I need muting. I need labels. I need whatever. And there's like a million of those things. And people won't use your email client unless it has all of them or all the ones that they are interested in. So you're stuck building it, all these things out first, and then you can try your little innovation on top, right? And so it takes some years.
You guys built out a full email. I remember you guys being really excited, and I have it still on my phone.
Yep.
That must have been a huge undertaking.
It was a huge undertaking, and it's a little bit easier on mobile to do because the user expectation is not so high for the email client on mobile. And you just need to get the core use cases right.
Does anyone use your email client over whatever the other thing?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because they want the Streak integration, right? The reason we built our email client was because it had integration with Streak.
I know. That is one of my biggest issues when I'm on my Gmail and my phone.
It's a big issue. And we're making
inroads there, too. Maybe I should just use it. Maybe that would be better.
We are making inroads there. And I think the right strategy, and we couldn't do it on mobile at the beginning, but the right strategy is to not build an email client and just be able to build your innovation on top, which is what Streak is, right? Like it's an innovation on top, and we leverage Gmail's email client. And we couldn't do it on mobile at first, but that's changing. There's concepts of Gmail add-ons that work on mobile. And so we're now integrated into the Gmail app, which is huge. And so in the same way that like, we don't want to build all those layers of crust.
Gmail has, like Google has. It's one of those incredible things.
Yeah, it's taking 20 years to build it.
Yeah, it took a long time. How long ago was Gmail like?
I think it's 2001 they started. Yeah, 2001.
I mean, 2000. Yeah, so 20 years. It's been 20 years since Gmail. They better have a big party next year.
Right.
In-person party. Close quarters. Everyone's close to
each other. And that's the other thing. Like we knew Gmail was like this stable platform. We made a bet on G Suite as the one that's going to basically take over. And for our customers, it did, right? It has like 90% market share.
How many years does Google Gmail have? Do you know?
I mean, so Gmail in general has 1.5 billion users. I mean, that's 1.5 billion active users, which is just insane. And so I think the other thing, I guess maybe this is generic advice, but it's just like, hey, if you're going to pick a platform to build on, build one that has a lot of users.
with 1 billion users.
Pick the one with 1 billion users because that's definitely helpful. And there's only a few of them. You know, there's like Facebook, iOS, Android, Gmail, maybe YouTube, and Amazon. You know, like there's not that many.
Pick one of those. You pick one of those, you will at least have enough users, right? Like they're at least enough people.
Or where all your users are at, right? Like maybe you're in the construction industry, and like all your users are using PlanGrid or something. I don't know, but wherever all your users are, pick that one, I would say.
One of the super interesting things about you is the profitability thing. And we talked briefly on this earlier, but what does happen? So if you just become a profitable business, but it doesn't necessarily hit venture scale, right? Like where it's a great business, like you know, it's profitable, millions, doing great. What happens?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'll tell you when I find out. But no, seriously. So like we were profitable pretty early. We raised the seed round right at the start of the company before we had any users or anything like that. Philosophically, we're not against raising more money. The thing is, like, we became profitable as soon as we started charging, and we've actually never been bottlenecked by money. Money hasn't been our bottleneck, right? Like, if at any point in the company you asked, hey, how are you going to grow another 50%? The answer was never, I need to do these three things, and these three things require money that I don't have. It's always been, we need to do these three things. So for us, not philosophically against raising money, but haven't needed to. Yeah, and so what happens now? Well, there's a different set of trade-offs, right? Like, so A, the type of people you hire is different because there are a lot of people that value financial stability while still having a startup-like feel, especially for engineers. Like, the dream goal is, like, a lot of them have been jaded by these, like, startups that are offering them equity with these, you know, huge financing rounds, and then, like, they fizzle out 9 months later or whatever, and, like, the company dies. And so, like, their equity was worth nothing. They took a lower salary as a result. And so, but there's a huge class of engineers that want the financial stability of a larger company, but the small feel of a startup. And that's basically exactly what we can provide. And so that's been really beneficial. Being sort of profitable, has we've been able to prove to prospective hires that, like, hey, this company's not going away in 9 months. You know, we're going to be here for the long haul. That's been really great. But yeah, there's just, like, different trade-offs. So we just recently introduced a bonus program, for example, a cash bonus program. Now, this is not normal in the world of venture-backed startups. It is very normal in other industries.
Older industry, yes. Yeah, like, cash bonuses are a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if you outperformed where sort of expectations were, like, yeah, you should get a bonus. And normally the startups would normally say, hey, but that outperformance is reflected in your equity. And no matter that your equity is going to be worth 0 in 9 months, but, like, you know, that's where it is. And so, you know, we've been able to do things like that that are different. And with COVID, you know, being profitable has obviously helped because we've been able to weather that storm. And I'll say, like, the last benefit has probably been CEOs spend a lot of time fundraising. Like, it's a lot of work. It takes a long time.
Well, it's a full-time job. You need to build the relationships. It's a marriage. It's not a date. You know, like,
right. So when you look at the pros and cons of it. Right. Yeah. When you look at the pros and cons of it, one thing that often I overlook is, like, oh, if I'm going to raise money, I get the money, but I get the dilution as well. But there's also another drawback, which is, like, you're spending 6 months on it. And what are you not going to do in that 6 months that you would have done?
So. And at some point you made a choice, right? Like, you made this choice. It was growing. You became profitable basically pretty quickly. Didn't need to raise more money. But I'd say some companies at that stage artificially will raise a round. So you're saying, like, money was never the bottleneck, but you probably have had options to raise, right?
Like, oh yeah. Yeah. We definitely have had options to raise. I think probably not on the most favorable terms, but we could have raised. And I think a lot of people in our situation might have actually done it just because for sort of defensive reasons. We didn't do it for that reason. We looked at the cost and benefit and didn't seem worth it for our business, for our industry. It's not sort of generic advice. But yeah, we sort of...
And how have you changed? I want to hear more about how you have had to change as almost leader. How big's your team?
30 people.
Yeah. And so how have you had to sort of, you know, yeah, I guess when you start a startup, sometimes you're thinking we're going to go straight to the top, right?
Like, right.
And at some point you had to make the conscious decision. You're going to be profitable. You're going to be a healthy business.
To be clear, you can be profitable and still grow, right?
Completely.
Like, we still have a growth
mindset. It means
mindset.
You have money to funnel into the company.
Right. And so, like, some people sort of equate, you're either, like, on a venture track and venture scale and venture growing, or you're dead. That's the first mistake people make. Then they go, oh, well, yeah, there are these profitable businesses in the middle, but, you know, they're lifestyle businesses and they're kind of like this, they're kind of flat, right? And it's like, no, there's another option, right? There's profitable businesses that are growing and doing very well. So, like, we still have the mindset of, like, oh yeah, how do we get 100% growth this year?
Because at the end of the day, that's the dream.
Yeah, it's the dream.
From an investor standpoint also, right? Like, you want to be working on, your ideal is to build something that you believe in and you're worth building, right? And over a long period of time, make it successful.
Right. And I think this is where there's a little bit of an issue with the venture model, right? Like, the venture model is sort of predicated on get big, yes, but get big quickly, because that's how you calculate your IRR, right?
It's steroids, right?
Yeah,
like, it's...
Yeah. Well, just in terms of, like, you know, ROI for their LPs, it's like, you know, the IRR is calculated over time, And so, like, the longer
as a venture investor, yes, yes, completely, I completely agree.
And so this is where it's a little bit different. Like, the alignment might be a little bit different with founders and investors in this situation. So this is an area that, like, we're still kind of struggling with, and I think it deserves a little bit more formalization. Like, what happens to these companies?
What should we call it? Let's name it. Let's name this. Oh, interesting. Because, yeah, I mean, because you're right.
Historically, they've been named great businesses.
Yes, but it's almost like I'd say when you're in venture, all you see is venture, right? Like
So when you're a farmer,
all you see are farms. When you're whatever, and so you live in this world of like vernacular and the words we use are.
So I think venture calls it unicorns, right? For the ones that hit the billion in 9 months, and I think the business we're working on is more aptly named like a workhorse. Instead of a unicorn, it's a workhorse, right? Like,
it's a strong workhorse
that like never lets you down.
I love it. Let's fund all the workhorses. I like, we say be the cockroach, but cockroaches are like pre-workhorses, right? Like,
right.
Cockroaches are like survive until you figure out how to be above the line. And then once you're above the line, I love it. Okay, workhorses. Yeah. I just want fun workhorses. That's all I want.
and this scenario, there needs to be some innovation. I think there's some investors doing this, but there needs to be some innovation in like, how do you fund these workhorses? Because the math kind of changes a little bit, right? Like,
well, it's more long-term, right? Like it's, you truly do want a 20-year partnership at some
point. Oh, yeah. I'd love to say it was a master plan, but now what I know now going forward, I'm glad that the investors that we have are patient and like can go over the long term. But the thing to figure out is what do you do with these businesses once they're 8 years old, 9 years old, they're profitable, they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger, not at the rate of being a $1 billion company in 9 months, but they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. How does that work for a fund that has a life cycle of 7 to 10 years? Right.
The truth is it doesn't. The other truth is there's a way to make that work. And so maybe someone needs to spend a lot of time like just focusing on workhorses. I love that we've named it this area of workhorses. I think there's a huge opportunity to back the workhorses. It's hard to find them because by the time
they exist, they don't need the money anymore.
The new part of this is tech workhorses, right?
Because there
was this era of like the workhorses, like Buffett loves workhorses. I'm pointing to his book, like they love the profitable businesses that pay out and just keep going. Right. But technology workhorses, we always thought about scale first, figure it out later, basically. Right. But
I mean, the great thing about tech workhorses is the margins are incredible. Like in software,
the margins are better. It's like you're a 30-person team, probably the margins are absurd.
But so I think the part that needs innovation is like by the time a company is a workhorse, they don't need a venture investor's money anymore, right? And so, but they did need it at the beginning. But also choosing at the beginning, like I think this is one thing that benefited us a lot was we didn't have to choose at the beginning. We didn't have to say at the beginning, hey, we're going for a $1 billion outcome, or hey, we're going to be a tech workhorse, or you know, we didn't have to say that. We could just build our business in the best way we knew. We didn't have to make that decision early. So I think maybe one model that might work is like some sort of investment at the seed stage, founders go for the big outcome. But I think what's going to become much more common, especially with SaaS software, is that a lot of these companies that go for the big outcome, if they fail to hit a big outcome, they're just going to become workhorses. They're not going to fail as a company. They're still going to do great.
Because the margins should be insane.
Exactly.
If you figure out who your customer is, the margins are great.
Right. And so like now you have this investor who invested in the $1 billion outcome, but now has a workhorse and maybe not aligned with their investment model or their investment thesis. And so I think what has to happen is there needs to be some like dialogue or mechanism that happens with like, hey, we're going to invest this money. And if you become a unicorn, here's the outcomes, here's how the payouts work. But if you become a tech workhorse, here's what we're going to do. And we're going to decide it from now. Because later,
from the beginning,
you
sort of have to decide it from the beginning. It is interesting. So we have some terms in our investment docs that are if you become a crypto company, basically, like because we had non-crypto companies become like add tokens or add something.
Right.
And it's sort of like it is a different structure. Like we still need to be aligned with the founders. And the goal is to be aligned with you, like the founders.
Right.
So really, at the end of the day, it's about dividing the personality type of these different companies. And then
finding a mechanism that works for each.
Yeah, finding the mechanism that aligns everyone. So it's like, if you become a workhorse, distributions right. every year or something. Right. They used to do that with public companies too. They right. don't really do that anymore. Everyone holds their cash and then buys stock back. That's the move. Okay, so I feel that we made a lot of headway on this workhorse scenario. So that brainstorm sesh was perfect. By the way, one of the things that's lacking, this is just an off-topic thing, that is brainstorming's hard during the pandemic. Have you found that? I feel working on problems via remote is...
I'm really worried about this, actually. This is the one thing I'm really worried about, because during the pandemic, we've had a lot of companies go remote. We went full remote. And for the most part, it's working for most people. But I think like the reason it's working for most people is because they were in person first. And they had the benefit of
Adding new people
is going to be hard. Yes, that's going to be hard. But also there's like this benefit of, hey, we had projects in flight, right? We were working on Streak version 3 before the pandemic. We knew the vision of that product before the pandemic. We knew exactly what it was going to be. We were working on it. Then we went full remote and we just kept executing. We didn't have to, brainstorm what is this product.
We just kept executing. We didn't need new.
Right. But now that Streak 3 is launched, we're starting new initiatives. And new initiatives, I'm worried about. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just worried about, because like a lot of people are saying like remote's working great. But like I think that now we're 6 months in? Like now people are going to start hitting this thing where a lot of the work that they're doing now is new and novel. And how does that work in a remote environment?
That's interesting. And a few companies have figured out how to build their whole business remote, which maybe remote first is going to be the way to do it.
It's definitely possible, because we see these companies exist. So we know it's possible. It's just harder than most people think.
I'm relating back to personality types, I think, a little bit, where it's like, I do just like as a person require that like being in a room with someone. Like I get the energy from it. I get like, I'm more drained at the end of like 4 Zoom calls than I am at 10 in-person meetings.
The pandemic has basically been the worst remote experiment possible, right?
Yeah.
Let's take a bunch of people who are worried about their friends and family and their health, stick them at home, lock them in their house, make them stare at a screen for 10 hours a day and not have any other human contact, and make sure that we set the expectations that you're performing just as well. How could that? That's possibly the worst remote experiment you could make. And so, what I'm hopeful for is that for people like you, that once sort of pandemic lifts and like we can get social contact outside of work, that it won't feel as bad in a remote environment for work that you're not getting that in room social contact. I think people are missing the social contact because they also don't have the social contact in their personal lives.
Completely. Okay. On that note, I'm going to move to the lightning round.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Ready.
Lightning round. Okay. You're trapped on an island. You can only eat burritos for the rest of your life. What game are you playing?
What game? Like what video game am I playing? I see. What game am I playing?
I put this context around it, and then like the actual question is about a game.
Got it. So it has nothing to do with burrito.
Well, it could.
I think actually a good thing, island plus burrito makes me think of surfing. I'm just surfing all day. That's all I'd be doing.
I would not have thought of that. And I think that's awesome. Are you a surfer?
Love it. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. And so you would need a coast. Like everyone's thinking about leaving. Like the big question is, do you leave California? And like,
yeah,
you need a coast.
We've had this discussion with my wife and, planning out our sort of future. And, everyone's thinking about, we're going to move here. We're going to move here. We have friends moving to Boulder. And I'm just like, you know what? California is pretty great. It's like a pretty great place. It's got mountains. It's got an ocean. It's big. There's a lot of land you can buy. Like, it's just a great place, And San Francisco is a great city.
I so respect, I like the, I hate that it's a hot take, but I respect the fact that you are loyal to the system.
It has nothing to do with loyalty. It's just objectively a good place to live. And, I think maybe that's spoken from a little bit of privilege because it's not cheap to live in the Bay Area, but California is plenty big. There's plenty of places to live in California, but it just objectively, it has it all. And for me, the surfing thing on the coast is kind of key.
So what is your favorite song to jam to when no one's watching?
So maybe with nobody watching I'll change the rules just a little bit. But one thing that I have twin girls that are 20 months old. And so anybody that's a new parent knows that feeding them is like super painful. Most parents do the kids songs or whatever, and I can't stand them. And so when I'm trying to get the kids to eat, I play Return of the Mac and have them jam to that, and we just have our lunch and dinner.
So I rap Eminem to my son while I change his diaper.
That's so good. Yeah.
And so like all my kids now can rap. Can't tell you what it really is. Only tell you what it feels like. They can rap it, and I take out all the swear words. And that's like awesome. it's literally like my 6-year-old, like if I start, she'll just start like saying it in the background, and it's because I do it so much. It's just on repeat now.
On repeat.
Can you rhyme? So this is relevant. Can you rhyme streak CRM with anything?
Well, streak is probably a good word to rhyme with. That's interesting. A lot of our customers call us. Sorry, I'm not.
No, dude, go for it.
I'm not answering your question, but a lot of customers refer to us as Streak CRM. And I'm curious where that sort of comes from for them, because we never position ourselves, market ourselves as a CRM, mostly because like we want founders to think of us as a product that they can be using for not just sales. Sorry, I'm going into pitch mode, but like really we built the product for ourselves. And so like it's really good at fundraising. It's really good for hiring. It's really good for sales. So we actually don't refer to
which are all CRM. Customer relationship management, but you're sort of saying like CRM specifically is sort of a
I feel like when people think of CRM, they think of like Salesforce. Right?
Salesforce. Like everyone thinks of Salesforce.
Exactly. And we don't really want to position ourselves.
What do you think of yourselves as?
That's a good question. We think of ourselves as like a layer on top of email. It's a way to do business email better. And so like the ultimate vision of the company is like, hey, if you're doing business processes in your email, which is, by the way, every business, because every business does hiring over email, do sales over email, they do fundraising over email, everything goes through email, then you need something that can handle that. And it's not just your regular mail client that's going to handle that. It needs to be something built for that purpose. And that's what Streak is.
Okay. Oh, well, is there a good word that rhymes with Streak CRM, just to finish off the question?
I can think of bad words.
Perfect.
So, freak.
Freak is perfect.
Streak is for the email freak. Yeah, let's go with that.
Hey, see?
Yeah.
You can ask one person one question. What person, what question?
Oh, that's really interesting. The thing that's been on my mind lately a lot has been, how do people find the work that they decide to do for the rest of their life? Like, there's a lot of people that find like a specific thing that they're super interested in, like asking Albert Einstein, like, hey, when did you know that like physics was your thing, right? What triggered it? Like, how did you know? Was it happenstance, or did somebody? And the reason this is all in my mind is because for my kids, and the thing I'm really interested about for them is like helping them find the thing that they could spend many decades on, because that's like one of the you start getting into sort of more philosophical questions about like, sorry, this is supposed to be a lightning round, right?
So the funny thing about lightning round is normally it makes up about like a pretty significant portion of the episode.
But it is a really philosophical question of like, how do we choose to spend our time as humans? Like, what's the purpose of it all? And I think personally, there is no purpose. The real purpose is finding something that you enjoy doing and becoming masterful at it. And so the biggest obstacle to that is not the hard work to become masterful. The biggest obstacle is like finding the thing that
you want to be masterful at forever.
Exactly.
Like, how do you, and then it's about perfecting, like, how do you keep perfecting it? And
exactly.
Like, it's like the guy, they always talk about the guy who's swords. There's a guy who makes swords and he was really, really good. And like they named those swords, it's like being Kleenex of swords.
And so like, how did that guy find out that like swords was his thing?
Swords was his thing. Some people, I'm genuinely jealous sometimes of people who like at 15 are like, I'm going to do this.
Right. And then they do
like, this is my thing. And it's because of a good, genuine reason that they're actually going to be on that quest forever. I think most 15-year-olds have no idea what they're going to be doing for the rest of their lives. But like,
and that's a question for parenting too, where, right? Like, if you see that your kid has a certain interest in certain things, like, do you want them to double down and focus heavily on that? Or do you want to give them more of a breath and like kind of encourage them to to try many different things in the hopes that one of them will be their life's work. But if they start finding that thing, do you double down and ignore everything else? Like it's a really tricky problem. So I think that's what I would ask, you know, any number of people that have been successful in doing these lifelong things.
I think it's like, a good question. It's a good question to ask people. When I talk to like really successful people, they always ask me one question, like at the end, like that they're thinking about. That would be a good question to ask at the end of every meeting. Just, yeah.
How did you get into your thing? Yeah.
Like it'll help you. It also helps connect because you're actually curious about the answer. There isn't a right answer.
Right.
Okay. Two people in the history of time you would want to have dinner with. Who are that?
Two people in the history of time who I want to have dinner with. I think Winston Churchill is one.
My grandpa is reading a Winston Churchill book and he loves the guy. He's just like, yeah, this guy's the funniest guy ever. So yes.
I don't know if I think I have kind of a bad reason for it though, because like all these great quotes are attributed to him, but I'm suspicious that they were all him. And so like, I kind of want to just have dinner with him to find out.
So it's like his speechwriter.
Yeah. Winston Churchill's speechwriter. That would be great. Yeah, that'd be great for dinner with. And then, yeah, I think it would be mostly people that have like honed their craft.
I like your thesis on mastery. I think that it actually fits very well with how you build your company also. Like how okay, last question. What is your definition of success?
It is definitely this mastery thing, because like, you know, I think people just want to live a good life, and the way you live a good life is you have to be fulfilled in many different areas. And yeah, there's obviously like the human relationships, but you need sort of purpose as well. And purpose doesn't have to mean like saving the planet, right? Like not everybody has to save the planet, and I'm glad that there are some people that are doing it. But that doesn't necessarily have to be everyone. And so you need to find a thing that you can devote yourself to. So my definition of success is being able to work on interesting problems, mostly in the software field, because that's my area of mastery, and then have time for human connections. It's like a pretty simple life.
Well, thank you for being on the Boost VC podcast. This was fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for tuning in during your busy day to learn about sci-fi technologies. For more info on what we do, check out our website at www.boost.vc or give us a follow on Twitter and Facebook at BoostVC. A big thank you to Maddie Callender, Coy Lee, and Ben Lavelle for their support in creating and producing this podcast. A musical thank you to Melodrive and their AI composer for our amazing intro and outro songs. If you need music for your digital content, check them out at melodrive.com. Lastly, thanks to Tim Hollowell with the Podcast Group in Washington, who did an incredible job mixing this audio. Boost VC is all about helping amazing sci-fi tech succeed. If you have an idea you think we should hear, get in touch with us at boost.vc/contact. And make sure to sign up to get notified when applications open for the next Accelerator Tribe. Also, we love to hear from our listeners, so rate us and drop us a comment on whatever streaming service you use. We would love to hear feedback. That's it for this week, and unfortunately, we don't have enough time for Mark Zuckerberg. But be sure to tune in next week when he's available. This is Adam Draper signing off. Pew, pew, pew.